Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back. This is Tom Salemi. You're now listening to the OIS Podcast. This is our second OIS Podcast of 2018, and it is a true joy to have you back. Had a great conversation with an old friend, Roger Longman. Roger is the CEO of a very cool company called Real Endpoints. Roger and I actually worked together, or more specifically, I worked for him when he was one of the two principals of a company called Windover, and they put out two great magazines, In Vivo and Startup Magazines. I was very proud to write for both. Roger, though, in my path, diverged a bit after Windover had been acquired, and Roger moved on to start this this company, Real Endpoints, which is really finding itself in the eye of the pharmaceutical pricing storm at the moment. In this conversation, I got to talk to Roger about a lot of things. We talked a bit about the pricing pressures facing pharma, why they're drawing so much attention now. But then we, of course, got more deeper into the issue of the day for ophthalmology, which was Spark Therapeutics' pricing of Luxturna. It got a lot of headlines at the end of December. We talked a bit about what Spark did right in coming up with the strategy and in working with payers. It's already signed a deal with Harvard Pilgrim up here in Boston. And we talked also about some of the cool mechanisms that Spark put into its agreement and likely will put into to other agreements going forward. So Roger knows this stuff really well. It was really great to talk to him and get his assessment, not only of Spark's situation, but of the issue more broadly facing pharma companies that are dealing with having to understand who is going to pay for their drugs and how they're going to pay. This wasn't always a challenge that biotechs and biopharmas had to face. So we're, of course, starting to see this in ophthalmology, and I think it's a real timely conversation. So thank you, Roger, for taking the time to bring us up to speed. Before I get into this conversation, though, I did want to let you know that we are looking at a deadline coming up for registration prices for OIS at ASCRS, which is happening on April 12th. It'll be in D.C. The full price of the conference is $1,095. At the moment, though, if you register before February, you'll save a couple hundred bucks. It'll be $895. So that deadline is approaching. It's February 1st. So if you know you're going to be attending OIS at ASCRS, might as well register now. Just go to OIS.net to sign up. Now let's get into this great conversation with Roger Longman of Real Endpoints. Well, Roger Longman, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great to reconnect with you. You and I worked together for quite a number of years. In fact, I think this is our anniversary of bits. I think we first met on the Monday of a J.P. Morgan at Sears. I was having breakfast. You were having breakfast, and you came over and said hello. So
that's right.
It's nice to connect on this very special day. So we're here to talk about Luxturna and gene therapy pricing and drug pricing overall. But I want to first let our listeners know what you do at Real Endpoints, what Real Endpoints does, and who are your clients, what are your products. Give us a bit of background.
Well, we are a company. We use a set of tools to focus on to increase market access and maximize pharmaceutical and diagnostic value. So we are 100% focused on market access. We have a number of proprietary approaches to assess the value and economic impact of drugs and diagnostics.
How timely is that?
Well, we think it's fairly timely, and we have we help our clients, largely pharmaceutical and diagnostic companies, to develop integrated clinical and launch strategies to optimize their launches. And once things are launched, we have a number of diagnostics which focus on access tactics and execution and see how well client companies compare to either their competitors or to the market in general. And we're working fairly heavily in the world of value-based agreements. So we have a number of clients with whom we are working with and payers whom we are working on deals which involve risk sharing.
Interesting. So you had started the company a few years ago, but we're seeing drug pricing really making front page news today in the last couple of years, I should say. So again, you've been very timely with the creation of the company and now the surge of interest in the space. Just overall, why are these conversations making the front page today? Is it just driven by politics, ACA? Is it merely farmers' turn to get sort of looked at as we examine healthcare costs? Or is there something really more substantial at play?
Well, I guess there are a couple of things. I don't really think it has much to do with politics, except that politics certainly underlines the problems or highlights the problems when it serves the politicians' interests. But ultimately, I think the real issue is business. Employers who pay for a significant amount of health care in the U.S. and state governments, which also pay for a significant amount of health care through Medicaid, and the federal government are all pretty concerned with the increase in health care costs. And the fastest important cost sector, the fastest growing cost sector, is specialty drug. And that's causing not merely premiums to increase, but it's also because of the way these plans are managing their costs, it's causing a lot of cost shifting to patients. So patients are paying more for their drugs, not simply because the prices are increasing, though that's true, but because they're now asked to pay a larger share of the drug bill. So those two issues, I think, are the most important factors in our focus on prices these days.
So where are we in sort of the management of that with, or the addressing of that with, value-based contracts and such? I know you do a great amount of work there. Is this management of drug pricing just beginning? Is it still in the very early nascent stages, or has it really kind of moved to the main stage and is a substantial part of the entire pricing infrastructure?
Number of questions there, Tom. So let's start for where are we on pricing or on on access. The one thing that has really shifted over the last couple of years, the single most important thing, is that industrial customers, call them the payers, the insurance companies, or call them employers, or in any event, groups who have largely an economic interest in reducing the growth in healthcare costs, have become the dominant player in decisions around drug access. So a few years ago, certainly when you and I were working together at Wendover, the physician was the main decision maker when it came to which drugs were going to get used, and payers largely simply paid the costs. What's happened is that as those costs have gone up, the physician has lost a lot of his power, his or her power, to select a drug, and payers or their agents, such as the pharmacy benefit managers, are making a much more concerted effort to select which drugs are going to be made accessible or easily accessible to patients, which limits the prescribing choice of physicians. It's not that patients can't get the drugs theoretically. They can. They just have to pay out of pocket for them, which in most cases means that they're not going to get those drugs. So that industrialization of the pharmaceutical prescribing choice has been the single most important change in the pharmaceutical industry since, I think, the development of biotechnology. This has changed the world. It has changed everything about commercialization. When you then go on to ask about value-based agreements, they are still not mainstream. The fact is most drugs go through a fairly defined contracting process, which simply allows a company to create volume in a particular plan in return for rebates. And those are very simple. They have been easy to manage. They're easy to track. They're the pattern, and people rely on patterns. What's changed is that increasingly employers and other ultimate payers want to be sure that the drugs that they are buying are actually providing some benefit. And as simple as the analogy is, I think it's worth making. Essentially, if you buy any other product and that product doesn't work, you return the product, or the company fixes the product, or the company sends you a new product. That's not true in healthcare, and it's not been true for drugs. But as the cost, particularly of specialty medicines, has increased so much, employers who are the customers of the insurance companies and insurance companies themselves and states are increasingly interested in making sure that if they buy a drug or if they pay for a drug, that they're paying for something that works, that is going to deliver the benefit that its clinical trials have promised it would. And that's the underlying theory behind value-based agreements. But these are much more complex to do than the simple usual rebate for volume contracts, which have traditionally defined the pharmaceutical contracting process.
Is there a universal understanding of what works, whether a drug works or not, what that means? I mean, for different diseases, obviously.
That's a great question, Tom. In fact, that's one of the key issues here. How do we know what working means? So, for example, you could say in some serious disease, the drug might, or the patient might, using the drug, improve his health status. Or he might, his health status might remain as it is, or his health status might worsen. The question becomes, if he had not taken that drug, would his health status have worsened significantly more? So it's not always easy to figure out what it means to say a drug is working or not. Sometimes it is. It's sometimes very easy to say, for example, that a cholesterol drug lowers cholesterol because you can take a test which shows whether the LDL-C level has gone up or down. But even that is actually not so simple to execute, largely because health plans don't generally have access to lab data. So they don't know. They can't quickly judge whether a patient or whether a population of patients has actually seen their LDL go down or up. So it's not, even when you know whether a drug is working or not, or one can theoretically know, sometimes the data isn't available to allow you to make that determination.
True. Or there are other factors. The patient's still having the French fries or started having the French fries or whatever might complicate that scenario.
Or indeed doesn't take the drug. But in you know, we can generally figure out when the patient isn't adherent to his medicine, or at least we've got good proxies for that. But in terms of deciding whether a drug is improving condition or not, can often be complex, and that's a lot of the, and frankly, that's a lot of the work that we do.
We'll take a quick break from this conversation with Roger to ask you to do us a few favors for the OIS podcast. Normally, I make these requests at the end of the podcast, but why not ask up front? If you enjoy the podcast, and I hope you do if you've gotten this far, you could help us out by giving us a ranking on iTunes. Let us know how we're doing. If you rank us on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, it helps other folks find the podcast. Also, if you're talking to your colleagues in ophthalmology, talk up the podcast. Let them know what we're doing. We'd love to have more people listening. We're very, very pleased with this community. But the bigger it gets, I think the more powerful it'll be. Finally, of course, reach out directly to me. My email is tom@healthag.com. Healthag is spelled like the word health, followed by the letters EGY.com. Healthag is the company that produces not only the OIS podcast, but the OIS event. So we're very proud of the content platform that we've rolled out. We'll continue to roll out more programs and products going forward, but would love your help promoting the podcast, and also would love to hear from you about what are some of the issues we should be talking about on this podcast in 2018, and who are some of the people we should be talking to. Now let's get back into this conversation with Roger Longman. Well, it would seem to me that ophthalmology would be one of those areas where the measurement of the effects of a drug would be easier. You can measure a person's vision before and after, and you can determine whether it's improved or not. But there's complications there as well. And with that, we'll move into the conversation about Luxturna, which was put out by Spark Therapeutics and approved by the FDA after a very moving advisory board meeting with patients sharing their experiences about seeing stars for the first time. Again, an accurate and irrefutable measure of a drug working. But even that, since the company has come out with a price for the drug, $425,000 per eye, there's been a lot of discussion as to whether that is worth it. First, I'm getting ahead of myself, as I sometimes do. Let's talk about the significance of the Luxturna approval and the setting of the price for a gene therapy. What was your take of the process, and what does the approval and the price sort of mean for this gene therapy space overall?
First of all, it's a wonderful new medical innovation, and it's astonishingly cool to see something like this. It's I don't know if it's the first gene therapy, but my gosh, it's early, we've been watching gene therapy for decades, and to see something come out now is really exciting. In terms of the economics, there's a couple of points to make. The first one is that the drug was approved more quickly than expected, or at least more quickly by health plans than health plans expected, which meant that they were not perfectly ready for this approval, and that's always worrisome to health plans. The thing a health plan wants is certainty. They want it because, frankly, health insurance is all about. It's about managing risks, and the more certainty there is, the fewer risks they have to manage. And that means that there's kind of a scramble to try to figure out what to do about this drug. However, what you can say about Spark, unlike most small technology-driven companies, is that they were very good about talking with payers and payer influencers like PBMs early on. So we know that there were a number of discussions long before this drug was approved with health plans moving towards ways of managing, plans manage the costs, in fact, through risk sharing or through other interesting approaches that could lower costs of this therapy beyond what might otherwise be expected. So let's start first with the risk sharing. One of the interesting aspects of this drug, of this contract, is that there is a double endpoint. That is to say, is the therapy working within a couple of months? And then is the therapy working after, I think it's 30 months? And that look back is really a valuable feature of these deals for plans, because you don't want, you know, if the drug stops working after 6 months or 9 months, the plan is kind of out of luck. If you think about, for example, the Kymriah agreement or proto agreement, there's actually no agreement as I understand it right now. This is a cancer, this is a cell therapy called a CART, CART therapy, or CART therapy, that is for a very small population of pediatric cancer patients. And the deal that Novartis has proposed for it is to check in after, I think, a couple of months and see whether the thing has worked. But of course, in a one-time therapy like CAR-T or like Luxturna, that's not enough. What you would really like to know is it working long-term? Now, what's also intriguing to me, or interesting, and for which I really congratulate Spark, is that what Spark's deal shows is that the even if the patient has moved from the plan with which they have the deal to another plan, the Spark deal will reimburse the plan with which it signed the deal in the first place. So if the therapy stops working 30 months later, that initial plan, in this case Harvard Pilgrim, will actually get the money, whether or not, will get the rebate, whether or not that patient is still in the Harvard Pilgrim plan. So, you know, I think I have to say they've done a really interesting job on this, and I congratulate them.
It sounds like you commend them for getting in early and talking to payers. Is that a conversation that doesn't frequently happen? That these companies will go in without these conversations, the sort of negotiations starting with payers? And is it something that you think we'll see more frequently going forward?
Yeah. Most companies do not do them for a variety of reasons, including the fact that most biotechnology companies don't really have an understanding of the payer world. It's complex. You know, there are multiple different lines of business within any insurance company or within most insurance company. And those different lines of business have different incentives and require different economics from any contracts they sign. So Medicare is going to be different than commercial, and commercial is going to be different than Medicaid. And each one of these, and companies need to understand those differences. Similarly, they need to understand the highly complex world of healthcare data within a plan and how that data flows. How do we know, back to the first question, back to one of your earlier questions, how do we know whether a drug works, and does the plan have the data that allows partnership to practically decide whether the drug is working or not? Other, you know, key questions, how much of the rebate is going to go back to the patient to reimburse him for his copay? I mean, there's lots and lots of complexities here. And different plans will have very different points of view depending on how they make money, on which line of business we're talking about. So, you know, I understand why plans don't do this, but you know, we're working on half a dozen of these things right now. And the fact is that virtually all of the payers that we work with tell us that, you know, companies come to them and say, we'd like to do a value-based deal. This is all pre-approval. And then expect the plan to sort of come up with the contract or come up with the structure. And plans are busy. They can't do that. And that means that a company needs to be doing this. But if they do this in a stupid way, in a way that doesn't fundamentally make sense within the payer system that we've got, they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot. So they really need to understand this world very deeply, very carefully, before they start making moves here. Unfortunately, they need to start making moves well before approval.
It sounds a lot like what we've seen on MedTech for quite a number of years, understanding of payment reimbursement. But what it is interesting, the rebate aspect, I mean, that is a whole different type of business that will have to have a whole different infrastructure to sort of manage patients going forward into months and even years. That is that something that that Spark or another biotech will need to manage? Will need to have a team in place to follow patients as they go through treatments?
I don't think that Spark will allow that to happen because that's hardly a way of guaranteeing impartiality in judging results. They need a third party, which is, you know, again, what we do is we make sure that both sides are can trust the results of the use of the drugs and the data and ultimately the economics that go back and forth between plan and manufacturer. But if you don't have a third party, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure.
So what goes into the creation of the price, the $425,000 per eye? Is that are you looking at the change in life, the fact that a person may be able to work again versus not work again? Is it more a measurement of what the market is willing to pay? Is it a combination of both? Where does that figure come from?
Tom, I really wish I knew. The fact is that pricing for many, many different therapeutics is I don't even want to call it a black art. It's not. It's often a finger in the wind. I've just heard way too many stories about how a company would have done huge amounts of pricing research and done lots of health economic analyses to define what the value of that drug is to society, what the value of the drug is within a certain time period, and so on and so forth. And they come out with a price of X, and the president or the CEO of the company says, well, wait a minute, that's crazy. We need to get 2X. And suddenly the price is double. So in general, how should it be done is very different than how it is done. We've, however, seen companies, Spark is one of them, which has kind of responded, you know, talked through these issues with the marketplace, with payers, and with other influencers in that world early on. The most famous example of this is a drug from Regeneron called Dupixent, where I think the CEO recognized that his previous decision to price a drug called a PCSK9, Praluent, was wrong, roundly hated by payers. This was a drug for lowering LDL cholesterol called a PCSK9 inhibitor. And he priced it at well north, I think it was $14,500 or $14,600 or something like that. And the market just said, no way. And they had, I don't think, done very careful thinking about how the market would react to such a price or anything like that. But when they launched their next drug, Dupixent, for a disease called atopic dermatitis, it'll also have other indications as well, the CEO of the company, Len Schleifer, went around to many different payers and also to an independent value assessment group called ICER, I-C-E-R, in Boston, and talked to them about pricing. What should it be priced at? How should they think about this? And he ended up, this is a drug for a disease for which there is no other real new therapies or therapies that work. And this drug does work in this disease. And what they said is, well, the comparison is with the psoriasis drugs. And so what he did was priced this drug at a significant discount to the psoriasis drugs and at a level that this independent group, ICER, thought was, in fact, cost-effective. The drug had a lot of what I would call black marks against it from a payer's point of view, in that it was a brand new therapy for a category that payers weren't paying for. So it was new expense for a payer. And when there is new expense for a payer, they generally restrict the use of that drug pretty radically. So they had some headwinds in the marketplace to deal with. But, you know, they did a great job of mitigating those headwinds, of mitigating those difficult market forces, and have done, not brilliantly, but pretty well. You can't say it's, you know, the greatest launch ever, but it certainly was an okay one. And I think more a model for people to follow than certainly the model that they established with the drug that they launched a year and a half before, Praluent.
Terrific. It's great to have a model to follow. The final question, just going back to Spark, do you have any sense of if we're going to see wider adoption or agreements or additional agreements with payers? We have Harvard Pilgrim already lined up and announced. Do you think this will be a successful roll-up with other agreements announced in the short term?
Yep, I do.
That's great news. And a succinct answer. All right, terrific. Well, Roger, it's a pleasure reconnecting with you, and thanks for sharing your insights on this. It's obviously a very hot topic.
Thank you, Tom. Really appreciate it.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much, Roger Longmire, for joining us on the OIS podcast and for bringing us up to speed on the challenges facing pharmaceutical companies as they try to get paid for the work that they're doing. If anyone wants to find out more about Real Endpoints, its website is realendpoints.com. It's all one word, realendpoints, with points being plural, .com. And if you want to reach out directly to Roger, his email is roger.longman@realendpoints.com. And Longman is spelled with the ending M-A-N. So two great ways of finding out more on this topic. Thanks also, Roger, for coming over to my breakfast table 12 years or so ago at J.P. Morgan and for allowing me to work with you at Wendover. It was a great part of my career, and I wouldn't be here without that. So that's it, folks. I've already asked you to do us a few things for the podcast. It'd be great if you could, again, spread the word about the podcast. Now let me help you. On April 12th, we'll be having OIS at ASCRS. Once again, you have until February 1st to sign up for the discounted rate. If you know you're going to OIS at ASCRS, why wait? Save yourself a couple hundred bucks. Go to OIS.net. Register for OIS at ASCRS, and we will see you in Washington, D.C.